Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
So, yes, Hello. This week we are chatting to Peyton Reed about Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, and we're weighing and measuring that, as well as live-action and stop-motion comedy, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, Florian Zeller's weepy family drama, The Sun, and gay drama, The Inspection, plus con thriller, Sharper. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, Matthew?
I'm trying to keep up with The Last of Us, the new HBO series based on the popular video games. I'm enjoying that very, very much. It's very much a quality HBO show, very gritty, dark, quite savage in places, very high death count. Can't really get attached to any of the characters because they kind of, it's a bit of a revolving door with this kind of infected outbreak. I've never played the video games. I don't really know them, but in terms of the video game adaptations, it's just far and away the best one ever. I mean, that's perhaps faint praise in one sense, yeah. But it is very, very good.
Will you be watching the BAFTAs this weekend? That's the next awards ceremony that's coming up.
Oh, yeah, indeed, yes. Yeah, very much looking forward to that.
Who's your money
you're
on?
You're going, aren't you? You're going to be
I
there.
I am going, yes. I did the Golden Globes. We both did the Critics Circle. Doing the BAFTAs, sadly not got an invite to the Oscars. Come on now.
There's still time. There's still
Spielberg,
time.
Come on. Invite me.
There must be
I'll come along. Yeah, surely. Yeah. I'll just wait outside Man's Chinese Theatre. If anyone needs me, I'll be there ready to go. But who's your money on for BAFTA then?
For BAFTA? Well, I mean, All Quiet on the Western Front has got a ton of nominations, so it's surely got to pick up a few. I mean, or it could be one of those cases where it kind of gets nominated for everything and goes home empty-handed. The Color Purple is the kind of classic example of something that didn't fail to sweep the board. But I'd imagine that was going to do pretty well. What else have we got? The Fablemans. I think that's kind of in with a good shout. I mean, after the Critics' Circle, Banshees of Inisherin and Tar.
Yeah.
I mean, they're kind of neck and neck, really, aren't they? They've really surged forward. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them walk off with a few gongs between them.
And what about the Whale? That sort of seems to have sunk back in.
It does a little bit. It's one of those. Yeah, maybe peaked a bit. That's the trouble with awards season, isn't it? You get all these films from festivals that are touted very early on, but then they lose momentum and other things kind of creep up behind them. But I'd be more sure of Brendan Fraser winning at the Oscars than the BAFTAs, I think. I think he's got more of a chance there.
I think Colin Farrell will probably get it at the BAFTAs. On sort of home turf, it could be either Austin Butler or Brendan Fraser at the Oscars. Who knows? Or maybe it's Farrell again. Who knows? I love this time of year. We should, you know, we will have our sweepstakes in the office. We'll see who comes out on top. Anyway, if you are tuning into the BAFTAs, it is on BBC One and iPlayer on Sunday at 7 o'clock. Okay, shall we move on and think about things in a really small way?
There's a lot of small things this week, isn't it? It's the small week.
It's the small week, and it's a biggie to start out that small
thing.
It's this one.
You're an interesting man, Scott Lang. You're an Avenger. You have a daughter. But you've lost a lot of time, like me. We can help each other with that. Who are you? I'm the man who can give you the one thing you want. What's that? Time.
So this is Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, but essentially Quantumania. Ant-Man 3, isn't it, Matthew?
Yes. Basically, so, yes.
Where are we meeting Scott Lang this time?
So this is another kind of post-Endgame movie. We kind of find Ant-Man, he's basking in his fame of being one of the people who kind of instigated saving the universe from Thanos. He was the one who kind of started it all off after his discoveries in the quantum realm. So he's kind of enjoying his fame. He's written a memoir, but he's also slightly easily neglecting his daughter Cassie a little bit, and she's getting into trouble. She's landed herself in jail for the umpteenth time. So obviously he was away for 5 years, so she kind of missed him all that time, and she's lamenting the fact that he's not really embracing his superhero duties anymore. He's just kind of resting on his laurels. But then very, very swiftly, it cuts to the main plot, which is Cassie's been tinkering around with the quantum realm, the subatomic realm we've seen before in the previous Ant-Man films. We had more of a glimpse of that in the second one. But this time, everybody, the whole cast gets sucked into the quantum realm, sort of a la Jumanji. And there they find lots of mysterious, weird and wonderful things, and also a very sinister presence in the form of Kang, who we've seen before in the Loki series in a different guise, but he's being touted now as the big villain of this new phase, which is this is starting off phase five. So it's the end of the Ant-Man trilogy, but it's also the start of phase five. So it's got to kind of juggle those two things together to be an Ant-Man film, but also to set up
a massive arc.
A big arc. Yes, yeah. The big multiverse arc, because we're now in the multiverse saga. We finished the Infinity saga and we're now into the multiverse saga. So it's all about Kang, big bad Kang, played by Jonathan Majors, who's having quite a moment because in a couple of weeks he's the antagonist in Creed 3 as well. So he's already Man of the Year, and it's not even March, so he's doing pretty well.
I would like to see who might beat him to Man of the Year, because so far his performances have been exceptional. Before we talk about this film, shall we hear what director Peyton Reed had to say about it? Here's his chat with our very own Bradley Russell.
Those who have seen the trailers will know maybe that Quantumania seems to be heading into a slightly darker territory compared to the first two movies. Why did you want to push the franchise in that direction?
I think early on when we decided we were going to do a third one, Paul Rudd and I remember had conversations about if we get to do a third one, we want to beat Scott Lang up a little bit. You know, coming out of Avengers Endgame at the beginning of this movie, he's kind of doing a victory lap. He's resting on his laurels. He's written a book about his career as an Avenger and the battle and everything. But we wanted to, you know, remind audiences there's a lot more in store for him. But also, I think having done a third one, we wanted to mix it up and do something different, right? And also maybe take it out of San Francisco and answer the questions about what's actually in the quantum realm and peel back the layers of Janet's life down there. You know, we know from both the first two movies she was gone for 30 years. What was her life like down there? And what if she encountered another person down there who found themselves trapped down there? And of course, it's Kang the Conqueror. That all struck us as interesting, but we really wanted to mix it up.
Quantumania obviously does introduce Jonathan Majors as Kang. Why was now the right time to introduce him? And why against Ant-Man, who maybe many want to see isn't the most powerful Avenger?
That's exactly the reason. We got excited about the idea of if you introduce Kang, one of the great Marvel Comics villains, into the movies, who's going to be the first Avenger to go up against him. We liked the idea that Scott and Hope were the most unlikely Avengers to go up against him. On paper, it's an incredibly lopsided encounter. There was dramatic tension in that from the get-go. I was like, well, how can that possibly work? How's that going to be a challenge in any regard? What is that story going to be? We liked that, the challenge, and also sort of the mystery of that.
Jonathan Majors, I find, is like a very deeply fascinating, thoughtful actor. So what was that collaboration process like? Was there a lot of back and forth conversations, or did he very much leave him to his own devices with that?
There was a lot of collaboration. Jonathan and I, from the beginning, had every possible conversation about what the MCU's version of Kang was going to be like. And we gravitated toward the same thing. We talked about real world conquerors. We talked about Alexander the Great and Napoleon, and what could we draw from that? We talked about the fact that this is a character who has dominion over time, and as he says in the movie, he doesn't live in a straight line, past, present, and future. What would that mean? How would that affect the way he carries himself? How does he deal with other people? In life, we know we have a finite amount of time to live, and we choose to form certain attachments in our life. Would you still do that if you lived in this sort of continuous loop, or in these various different universes in the multiverse? We like the idea that maybe that relationship between Kang and Janet is the closest attachment he's ever formed. That seemed interesting, and to give our heroes a personal connection to that antagonist. And we also talked about the antagonist that we like the most in movies. And it's that thing about where you do understand their point of view, even if you don't agree with it. And maybe you have some empathy for that person, or also this empathy for the root cause of why that person's that way. We talked about all of this stuff and really had fun doing it. And mostly we talked about bringing that countenance into the Ant-Man world. The Ant-Man movies are generally sort of lighter and more comedic. And what if this very grave, powerful character shows up in that, you know, in those movies, in that tone, the collision of tones of Jonathan's Kang and Paul's Scott Lang?
We head down, obviously, into the quantum realm in this movie. So how did you land on the visual aesthetic and establishing the look of this environment, this, like, new location? Like, what inspirations and touchstones did you look towards?
It was a very long process of that started early on as we were writing the script and formulating the story. We always knew that that was going to be a big part of this movie, designing that world. Not only designing it visually, but also just how it plays out in the movie that sort of, you know, bars a little bit structurally from Wizard of Oz or Lord of the Rings or maybe even Apocalypse Now, right? Traversing this strange landscape to discover a powerful character at the end of that. We assembled with Will Tay, our production designer, a team of crazy artists from all over the world, in addition to our in-house artists led by Andy Park at Marvel, and just encouraged them to get creative and come up with their most whacked out concepts for characters, environments, all of it, and see if we could find a place for it in the movie. And keying off actual electron microscope photography and embracing what's unique. It's not outer space, you know, or Asgard. It is a subatomic world.
It really does feel like no idea was off the table. So, like, what is that creative energy and imagination? How does that benefit Quantumania as a movie?
It brings a bit of a chaos to it, and that served our story well, too, because Kang is a character whose whole agenda is to create control out of chaos. That's his character in the comics. That's his agenda in the movie with the multiverse. We had to very quickly show how vast the quantum realm was and that it was teeming with all sorts of life and energy and creatures, and they had to be very different from one another because we're telling the story of this, the freedom fighters who were opposing Kang, and they're all made up of these maybe last surviving members of all these different races of creatures, so they all had to have different aesthetics. That part was really fun, and it was a long but really fun process.
Now, Marvel directors often have, like, the unique challenge of picking up the torch of the MCU for a brief time and sort of shaping major plot beats without knowing what comes before, maybe, or what comes after. What is that like?
Well, we know what comes before, certainly. And then it's a matter of, like, what comes after. As we kick off Phase 5, we introduce Kang the Conqueror. We'd seen a little taste of one of his variants, He Who Remains and Loki, but that's a very different character. Kang the Conqueror is his own person. But we know from the comics that he has all these variants, and it leads to things like the Council of Kangs and what's sort of the political structure or the sort of mafia-esque structure of these various Kangs. And we like the idea that he is someone who's fighting our heroes. Maybe eventually he fights the Avengers. We understand he's fought the Avengers in the past from what he says in the movie. What does that mean? What does it look like? What does it mean to have a villain who's fighting the heroes but also fighting versions of himself? So we know what the potential of that is. We know what that can be in the future. But we haven't been prescriptive about what it has to be. And that's one of the cool things I think about Marvel is we do what's right for this movie, and whoever comes after us, they have to figure it out from there.
Now, Michelle Pfeiffer gets, like, a lot of meaty material in Quantumania. So could you speak to maybe, like, Janet's extended role in the movie and sort of how she's able to really draw out that hidden history of Janet?
We brought Michelle into the last movie, you know, Hank and Hope successfully rescue her from the quantum realm. And then there's a big, you know, sort of question about what now, right? Like, what's her life on Earth now? And we introduce her in a very domestic context. She's serving pizza to the family. And it's great. The family's back together. But is it great? Like, she's not talking about what happened down there. Throughout the story, she's forced to deal with the past, and the whole family's forced to deal with it. But we also see her come alive in the quantum realm. We see, like, oh, wow, she did have a very vibrant life down there. And you start to see her. She knows how the place is wired. She knows all the customs and rituals and all these people and how things work. And you realize that was the bulk of her adult life, and she's more alive down there than she is up here. We felt like we owed to the sort of, you know, the Marvel Comics, Janet Van Dyne is a very important character, and we wanted to pay tribute to that. We also love the idea of, you know, of Michelle playing Janet as an action hero in that section of the movie and having this very emotional backstory with the villain.
Now, Bill Murray comes into this film like a force of nature. So what was it like filming with him and sort of convincing him to sort of dive headfirst into the MCU?
Bill and I went out and drank tequila one night, and I pitched him the movie and his role in it. He loved it. He, you know, in true Bill Murray fashion, he'd never seen a Marvel movie, not one of them. He knew the comic books, and we talked about the fact that my first exposure to Bill Murray was there was a Fantastic Four radio show that Marvel did in 1975 that Stan Lee narrated it, and it went out to all these various radio stations in the States. And Bill Murray pre-Saturday Night Live, played the Human Torch in that radio show. So this is his second foray into the Marvel world. I think he just liked the idea of playing around. He wanted to come and do something and play a character who kind of turns out to be a heel, and I was thrilled because I grew up with Bill Murray.
You've obviously directed 3 Marvel movies now, and it does feel like once you're in that inner circle, you're maybe like an MCU lifer. Like, are there still corners of this universe you're desperate to explore?
I know all those characters. I grew up just immersed in that stuff. I love the Ant-Man characters. I mean, given the choice, Spider-Man, Hulk, Captain America, give me Ant-Man every time. I relate to the underdog version of that character. I relate to the everyman quality of that character. I would love to see what happens with Ant-Man and Wasp going forward. I love working at Marvel. I've known Kevin for a long time. I love that world, and I like that there's a variety of stories to tell. So who knows? We'll see what happens.
That's Peyton talking to Bradley. Matthew, you're a Marvel nerd. Is this doing the job of bridging that gap that you talked about between the end of Ant-Man trilogy and the beginning of this new phase?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it does a pretty good job. I mean, the tone of it is slightly different from the other Ant-Man films in that it's not quite as comedic in places. It doesn't have some of the comedy staples of, I won't spoil anything, but there's a few aspects that are missing from the original movies. But at the same time, it's good to see a threequel that kind of tries to do something different, and they have gone for this very epic tone. It's much more of a sci-fi movie than the other ones. I mean, the other ones were kind of like a heist movie and much more sort of grounded and smaller in scale. But this one really kind of amps up the scale. There's a lot more CGI. Majority of it is set in this fantastical realm. It keeps itself grounded as well. It kind of attends to the relationship between Ant-Man and his daughter, Cassie, who's played by Catherine Newton. For the first time, she's taking over from the previous actors who played the role. So it works as a kind of daddy-daughter film. I felt like they did neglect the Wasp, though, a bit. I mean, it's called Ant-Man and the Wasp, but their relationship doesn't really progress too much. I feel like Evangeline Lilly was left out a little bit. There's more sort of focus on her own mother, Janet Van Dyne, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, who does have a bigger arc in this film and has a complicated relationship with Jonathan Majors Kang. So we get quite a lot of that. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts in that way. But it does set up Phase 5 quite effectively. It teases quite a lot to come, bigger things to come, while still being a big movie in itself.
I really wasn't sure about this. I'm not that keen on the whole going quantum and business. It's not been something I've been a fan of, but I really enjoyed this. And I think it was probably because, you know, as you say, Michelle Pfeiffer has this much bigger role along with Michael Douglas. Yeah. And those two are just pure star quality.
They are.
Douglas has this absolute romancing stone twinkle in his eye and is just... Just great. Him and her are selling this quite ridiculous world with absolute sincerity. You absolutely believe in it. Michelle is sort of playing this kind of Obi-Wan character, taking, you know, Ant-Man as Luke Skywalker into this world. It was like going into the cantina, wasn't it? This is like weird creatures, strange worlds, like lots of lobby people. And, you know, it might as well have had... And so from that point of view, I mean, even I noticed on the credits, Skywalker Ranch did the sound on this film. So it feels so Star Wars-y. And even the sort of trying to get small things in holes scenario at the end felt a little bit Death Star-y, and the sort of, you know, the Rebel Alliance trying to rise up.
Yeah.
And I'm not mad about that. I enjoyed that aspect of it. And yeah, and as you say, Jonathan Majors has a lot to do here.
It's a big role.
Yeah, he has to turn up and convince you that this guy is absolutely terrifying, world-destroying, more sort of threatening than even old Thanos, worse than the Purple Meanie. And I think he pulls that off to some degree. Yeah. There's some silliness here. A lot of the time, I didn't really understand what he was doing with his different time bits and pieces. And
no, that's a bit tangled, isn't it?
It's all quite literally as tangled as the timelines that he's sort of spinning. But in terms of presence, this guy, he's sort of Darth Vader-y. He turns up and the way his accent, his cadence, his barely contained rage that he has really does set a tone for this character and what we may get from him and the potential from it. So I really enjoyed it.
I did too. he's got a big job to do, because obviously one of the future films is called Kang Dynasty, so we know he's going to be around for a while. And it wouldn't be a surprise to see him pop up in all sorts of places from now on because of the nature of the character. So, I mean, he's got his work cut out for him, but he seems to be really kind of relishing the chance to play this character who has these different layers. And I mean, he's already played him in two different versions. He played him in Loki as He Who Remains, but now he is Kang in this one. And so we will be seeing a lot more of him. And he looks like he's really going to dig into exploring all the facets of this character. And I think, I mean, you really do need good villains to make these films work. I mean, it's all very well having these great heroes with great powers and being relatable, but you really need the villains to up the stakes and increase the peril and the tension. So I think we're kind of onto a good thing with him in this one, certainly.
No spoilers, but Bill Murray makes an appearance. Did you enjoy Bill turning up? Who seemed a little bit not aware of what he was doing, but in a sort of delightful, befuddled fashion.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a shame that they did spoil that. I mean, you can understand why they want to put that in the trailer to kind of up the star power, but I kind of wish they maybe kept that secret. But there are some other big surprises that follow. There was a big cheer at one point in the big multimedia screening. My son was extremely excited by one development, which I think bodes well for some future installments. And there's all the kind of typical Easter eggs and cameos, little unexpected nods that pop up that you expect from a Marvel movie. They do some nice things with some previous characters from the Ant-Man franchise who return in unexpected ways. Mm. That's really fun.
Yes, one of those characters that returned, no spoilers, is a bit Humpty Dumpty, is all I'll say. And I enjoyed it on a comedic level, but on a kind of actually believing it as a character and as a character arc, struggled with that. And we should say there are two post-credit stings to sit through, don't leave the cinema. You need to sit there all the way through that crawl. It's quite a tricky film to talk about without spoilers, obviously.
Yeah, of course,
But I did like the sort of sense that, you know, the idea of, you know, if something's worth fighting for, you should go for it. And that there's one situation where a character just says to another, just don't be a dick. And that's great advice for anyone. And I liked that as a sort of theme. The whole theme of this film is
a lovely moral.
Just don't be a dick. You know, if worlds are going to collide and other worlds are going to die and you need to make a sacrifice, just don't be a dick about it. On that level, get that on a T-shirt. I'd wear it.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Yeah, that would be a great T-shirt slogan.
Just don't be a dick. Okay, so I think we're saying we would highly recommend this as a good time at the cinema.
Uh-huh.
Yep, indeed. and it's available on a very large scale. You can see it on IMAX.
I would recommend it in IMAX. Yeah, I enjoyed it in IMAX. Some of those effects really get in your face.
Yeah, I don't know what, like, if you did the like 4D experience, what sort of wetness you'd get, because there is goo and slobbery things, a lot of slobbery things. So maybe you'd get whipped in the face by wet things. I don't know, but
it's a very viscous movie.
It is viscous. There you go. You can have that for the poster quote, Disney. Viscous.
Very viscous.
Yeah.
Are you listening, Disney?
Yeah. What star rating did we give it, Matthew?
We gave it a high three.
High three.
Our reviewer, we don't give half stars in total film, but he said he would have given it a 3.5. And I think I would agree with that. I think by the standards of some of the other Marvel movies, not quite there, but still very, very solid. So yes, I'd be a 3.5 or high three.
Perfectly respectable start for this new phase then. So if you fancy seeing Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, it is in cinemas on Friday. Right, from CGI a go-go to stop motion, it's this.
Hi everybody, it's Marcel. I'm recording this video because I'm looking for my family.
Marcel Lachelle and the search for a family reunited. Marcel, how long has it been since you've seen your family?
I couldn't tell you, but a space in my heart gets bigger and louder every day.
Dean, do you know how long?
That's 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice to know.
So this is Marcel the Shell with the shoes on. Shell called Marcel who has shoes.
He has shoes on.
Tell us a little bit more about it, Matthew.
It's based on a series of YouTube shorts. It started off directed by Dean Fleischer Camp, and he's now made the leap to feature film directing with this movie. So it kind of builds off those series of shorts. Yes, and it's centered on Marcel, who's this one-inch talking shell who has these very dinky little shoes, these sort of Sonic the Hedgehog-type sneakers. And he lives alone with his grandma, with Nana Connie, who's voiced by Isabella Rossellini. We say that Marcel is voiced by Jenny Slate, as in the original shorts. And they live in this little Airbnb together. Oh, they have a pet ball of lint as well called Alan. He's another character. They live alone. And they're part of a larger community, but they've lost track of this community. So a good part of the film is about them trying to find out these other shells, if they can reconnect with these other shells, and they're being subjects of this mockumentary that's being made by Dean Fleischer Camp himself. So it's all quite meta, and Marcel kind of gathers fame. He does become a YouTube star, and he attracts the attention of the media, and then the media become invested in trying to help him find his community as well. So it's all about him sort of dealing with fame, but also yearning for his other kind at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's very cute, isn't it? And,
whimsical.
Very, very whimsical, to the point that it could hurt your teeth if you're not into that sort of thing. Did you enjoy it? I mean, for me, it felt like it was a YouTube short stretched too far. Mm. Did it work for you?
Yeah, to a point. Yeah, I did find it. Yeah, it's very sort of whimsical, cute. It sort of reminded me of kind of our old kids programs, like things like Morph and Bagpuss, this kind of small stop motion world. Oh, we should say that it's been Oscar nominated in the animated film category. I guess because a high enough proportion of it is animated, because there is quite a lot, there's a lot of live action in it as well, but I suppose there is enough animation. And it's very well done, the integration of the animation with the live action environment. But yeah, I did find it a little bit stretched thin. Not quite as funny as I was expecting. I felt like a lot of the big laughs were in the trailer, really. I did laugh. I liked his when he introduces the bread room, where he chills out. I thought that was a nice little pun. And I thought there was some very poignant moments as well, especially involving Isabella Rossellini's Nana. Who I liked her more than Marcel, I have to say. I found her the more kind of compelling character.
It's a weird disconnect as well. Like, I watched this with a small child who couldn't understand why Marcel is a boy but has a girl's voice. So you've got Jenny Slate doing this very cute, oh, hi, I'm Marcel, which is super cute, but for 10 minutes. And then you're like, okay, this kind of worn off. And I like the idea that, you know, you can watch this either as a sort of story about a little shell, or you can look at it as a sort of treatise on what happened to the Jews during World War II, whatever you want. It's about communities being disappeared overnight and what you do to find them and where they've been taken and this sort of thing. So you can read into it all you like, but I just didn't feel like I really wanted to read much more into it than the shell. And then I didn't feel like the shell was really giving me much more than that initial hit of delightfulness. That if you've never seen this before, it is delightful to see this little shell with this blinking eye talking cutely to camera and sort of falling off windowsills and falling into plants and trying to flip spoons and all sorts of things in this house and a dog trying to eat it. It's cute. But for a feature length, I think I wanted more.
Yeah. So what did your son make of it? Because I didn't watch it with mine. So I was wondering what children, how they would engage with it, whether it would hold their attention in the way, you know, like a Puss in Boots or something like that. It did seem perhaps a bit gentle and whimsical, really, to appeal to.
Yeah, my small person wandered off after 40 minutes and was like, what else is going to happen? And bored.
Yeah.
I have to say I felt similarly, but I don't have Lego to play with and no job. I do have a job, so I watched it. I think it's Oscar nominated because of the skill and the, you know, stop motion is delightfully done. It's beautifully done. And it's incredibly cute. And also, we don't see a lot of that. I mean, obviously, we've seen Pinocchio, but we, up until now, we haven't really seen very much stop motion. So I think the Academy has embraced that. I don't think it has a hope in hell of winning, do you?
It's Pinocchio's to lose, really. I think Pinocchio or Turning Red or even Puss in Boots. Yeah, it's probably the outsider. But I mean, I can see Marcel having a future. I'm sure we'll see more of Marcel because
You're thinking we're going to get Marcel 2.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll return in some form. I thought there was some quite poignant moments, but otherwise, I thought the resolution was kind of reached a bit too easily. It builds up this tension, and then it's like, oh, that's it. We're done now. We've reached the point. So it wasn't perhaps in storytelling terms the most compelling. And like you say, it's more about the skill on show, really. That's the main appeal, I think.
I also spent quite a bit of time thinking, how is Marcel doing certain things without arms? And also like feeling quite disquieted by his large eye, singular eye. And then very upset when Grandma had a bit of her shell knocked out of her.
Yeah, that's quite distressing, isn't it?
Moment. I don't know. Maybe I need to try again with it, but it really didn't click and connect with me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think I'd rather watch the shorts, really. I think Marcel in small doses would be more appealing.
A small shell in small doses. But if you fancy a big dose of Marcel, he is out in cinemas this Friday. Okay, let's move on to the trials of parenting now.
What are you doing here?
Nicholas hasn't been to school in almost a month.
I wanted to ask, how are you? Has something happened? You realize the school is talking about expelling you? Can I live with you?
You said you don't feel very close to people your age.
Your other son, he needs you as well.
And you were at work all of the time.
Has he been able to talk about the divorce?
I've tried to be there for you. I've tried to give you strength. What's going on? Are you on drugs? You think you can just live your life doing whatever you feel like?
I don't know what's happening to me.
So this is The Son, Florian Zeller's follow-up to The Father. Is he just going to do films that are the something, the daughter?
The mother's the other part of his
trilogy. Yeah, so right. I don't know if this is like forever now. He just does the family member. But this is The Son. Tell us who The Son is.
He's called Nicholas. He's played by Zen McGrath. And his parents are Hugh Jackman and Laura Dern. And they're separated. And Hugh Jackman's Peter. He's started up a new life with Vanessa Kirby's Beth. And they've got a young baby. But he also has this teenage son, Nicholas, who's very troubled. He's having some real mental health struggles. And Peter and Laura Dern's Kate are struggling to know what to do with him, really, how to help him. He sort of pings between the both of them. He's clearly very distressed by what happened between his parents. He's feeling quite adrift. This is a fact in the way that the father was about dementia. This is also another film about mental health, but in this case, it's more about depression, especially teenage depression. So that's the big theme of the film, and it kind of explores that in a quite sort of soapy family way. It's like the father. It's quite small scale. It's mostly set in apartments and offices. So I mean, you can sort of see that it is based on a stage play. It's quite stagey in that kind of fashion. And obviously you can't help but compare it to The Father, which won two Oscars, but this one hasn't been nominated. Although Hugh Jackman was nominated for a Golden Globe, so I think that kind of suggests that it's not quite on the same level as the Father.
No way. No. I saw this at Venice and was deeply disappointed. As you say, it feels really soap opery. Certain things are telegraphed miles away. You see something coming. I mean, if you didn't see that thing coming, then you were not paying attention because it was so flagged.
It's a bit of a plot hole, really.
Isn't it? And apart from, I obviously feel for anyone going through this sort of trauma and torture, but the kid playing Nicholas just wasn't a very good actor. I feel like in casting, they wanted a Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah, he's very similar.
And they just got a curly-haired boy who does a lot of sniveling and doesn't really bring a lot of nuance to something that is a very difficult role. Fair play to him, has a really good stab at it, but I just don't think he really has the skills to elevate this up to where it needs to be. It's very nice to see Hugh Jackman doing more dramatic stuff and also happily sort of tapping into a character that isn't always likable. or sympathetic. I enjoyed that. And, you know, Laura Dern is just doing Laura Dern in a very dependable fashion. We've seen her do this before. But if you're looking at this in comparison to The Father, which is unavoidable in terms of filmmaker and title and sort of tone, The Father is far superior, far more emotionally engaging, and just a much more finessed and nuanced thing than this, which feels very, very blunt instrument.
Yeah, I mean, The Father was not so much, it wasn't so much melodrama in that, it wasn't so plot-driven, whereas this one, it does kind of rely on those tropes a lot more, especially in terms of, like you said, this thing that is signposted very early on, you're just waiting for it, and the way it's resolved is kind of meant to be a shock, but it really isn't. And then there's that kind of divisive coda as well. I mean, how did you feel about that? The final scene without
it felt like spoilers. there was a sort of which is sort of like a wish fulfillment and sort of a having a cake and eating it scenario that felt really sort of soft peddling on something that is the issue at the heart of this, which we can't say because of spoilers, is dirty and hard and painful and nothing soft and lovely and romantic about it. So this coda feels like a weird softening of something that we should be rightfully rageful about and concerned about. Like, what do we do about this epidemic that's happening amongst teenage kids? And so it felt like it sort of backtracked on its own resolve. So I didn't love that. Did you?
Well, I mean, I couldn't help but feel moved by it. But yeah, at the same time, it did feel a little bit contrived, really. Yeah, certainly not as powerful as the way the father ended. It does really invite those comparisons all the way along.
I mean, maybe it says more about me that I enjoy a really bleak ending that really gut punches you and makes you feel like, oh my God.
It feels more honest, doesn't it, really? Rather than, like you said, that it's softened.
The father feels really authentic, and that's what would happen, and that life isn't fair, and that maybe we need to all think about what we're doing with our older people. Whereas this feels like, that's hard. That's a horrible thing to look at, but have a look at this, because this is a nicer sort of thought process, and we don't have to really think about that. And actually, we really do. So it actually rubbed me up entirely the wrong way, Matthew.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm sorry, Florian. It really did. And then poor old Vanessa Kirby, who's a fantastic actress, Pieces of a Woman, she is splendid in, and we've got her coming up in Ridley Scott's Napoleon. Here, she's just literally woman left holding the baby, just
holding
literally
the baby,
that.
Yeah.
What a waste of her talents. So yes,
yeah.
For me, this isn't worth a cinema visit. I would save this for
that's
home ends.
Thing. Yeah, I did kind of wonder because of the themes and the way it's scaled. I do kind of wonder who's going to want to flock to this on a Friday night. Really, it's not ideal for cinemas. I do feel like this perhaps should have been a streaming movie. Perhaps it would draw more attention and be an easier watch in your living room rather than at your multiplex at the weekend. Despite these huge stars, it doesn't feel very big or cinematic.
Yeah, and it also feels like it would be a film that you perhaps might want to watch with your teenage children in the comfort of home, where you can pause it and say, do you recognise this? Do you feel this? Or how is this making you feel to watch this? I feel like it might be better served for a home entertainment release.
They kept saying about Hugh Jackman's character, about how he's so busy in the office. Like he can't pay attention to his son because he's working so much. But every time you see him in the office, he's just kind of staring out the window. He's just like doing prayer hands. He doesn't seem to be like looking at his emails or looking over paperwork. He's just kind of mulling in his little office, spectacular view. So that irked me quite a bit, really.
And we probably should say that a star from The Father does appear in the sun devastating effect. I enjoyed that little cameo. Let's not say who, but it's a corker. And it feels
savage.
Like savage and feels completely different tonally and everything else from the rest of the film. I'd have liked more of that kind of film than the film we got.
That's the most memorable moment.
Okay, so if you fancy The Sun, it is in cinemas from Friday. Okay, 10, shun, Matthew. Drop and give me 20.
Just like being in the office.
It's time for boot camp with this.
Real question is, why do you want to be here?
I want to be a Marine.
That's not good enough.
To be a good Marine means to know thyself and seek
self-improvement.
That means you, Gavin!
Aye, sir!
They kicked you out, didn't they?
My mom? She won't even talk to me. Most of my friends are dead or in jail. If I die in this uniform, I'm a hero to somebody.
This is The Inspection. Matthew.
Yeah.
What is this about?
This is a semi-autobiographical movie from writer-director Elegance Bratton. It's based on his real life experiences as a Marine, a Marine boot camp, and also dealing with homophobia. Both those topics are very much at the center of this movie. The main character is Ellis, played by Jeremy Pope, who got a Golden Globe nomination for his role. And I think a lot of people expect him to get an Oscar nomination. It's quite stripped down in plot terms. He goes to boot camp, but he has to deal with a lot of prejudice. He's black, he's gay, and this is in the early noughties, the kind of don't ask, don't tell era in America. So he's facing all these struggles, and there's a tough as nails drill instructor played by Bokeem Woodbine. He's locking horns with on a daily basis, and also with a lot of the other recruits. So it really is about this external and internal struggle that he's going through. He's going through struggling to complete the training in the face of all these obstacles, all this prejudice from everybody surrounding him. And there's also his own mother as well, played by Gabrielle Union, who's very religious, devout. So she's struggling with her son's sexuality as well.
This sort of reminded me of Moffy, the South African drama about a gay recruit into the army there. But where that really didn't work for me at all, this really does. And it also recalled An Officer and a Gentleman for me. You know, the scrappy underdog really trying hard to better themselves, mm-hmm. not only from a social point of view, but from an emotional point of view, to feel that they're worthy. Somebody who feels unworthy in themselves, trying to find that through the military and the struggle that is. And also this idea of the military being, you know, sort of almost a gay fantasy in itself, the sort of sweating men and hardcore sort of abuse being something that is actually sort of almost sexually alluring to him, but at the same time, terribly dangerous. Like, he cannot show his true colors whatsoever. So that sort of push pull, I think, is really done well in this film. And I think Jeremy Pope is amazing in this.
It really is.
He's a gay actor himself. I really think there is something that he brings of himself to this, a real melancholy and real nuance. And I thought he was wonderful. And the scenes with his mother were heartbreaking. Gabrielle Union,
they really are.
So harsh to her son. You know, she gives him the birth certificate that he needs to join up and says, you know, this represents the last of the dreams I had for you, because he's failed her so spectacularly with his sexuality and his sort of life choices. Yeah, it's really engaging.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a complicated relationship, because she does love him. She really does. She worships him. But at the same time, she just can't come to terms with who he is. With his sexuality, his identity. So you do have this real struggle, this real tension there. I really, really enjoyed it. I really like the kind of the stripped down nature of it. The performances are absolutely terrific. And the director said that he was influenced by Moonlight and Rocky. So, I mean, I was totally on board with that straight away, because I love both of those movies. So that was perfect for me. And I do love a basic training movie as well. I always find those kind of irresistible, the underdog kind of struggling and making progress and showing what he's worth. I always like that. That's always fun to watch.
Yeah.
And Bokeem Woodbine, he's such a force of nature as well. And this, he's perfect as the drill instructor. He's so hard as nails.
I think we both agree we enjoyed The Inspection, and it's worthy of your cinema ticket money.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, it feels quite small. It feels like one of those films that really makes the most of its budget. And the intensity, I think, of it lends itself well to a big screen. Yes, I'd recommend seeing that.
Yeah. And also an opportunity to see Pope, because I'm sure we'll be seeing more of him. He is electric in this. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. So The Inspection is in cinemas from Friday. Final film now, Matthew. Keep your wits about you. Yeah, here we go. It's this.
celebrating?
What exactly are we celebrating?
Billions of dollars. Roll up your sleeves. Trust me. You can't cheat an honest man. That's why we never feel sorry for the mark.
I really like you.
I really like you too.
You lied to me.
We're all human. Just doing the best we can.
You cause your mother anguish, and I will not have it.
She wants me gone.
How do you think it's been?
Not well.
Okay, so this is Sharper. Very tricky for you to describe what this is about without giving away the twists and turns. It's a twisty-turny.
It really is.
Oh, no, she is. Oh, he's a... Oh, they are. Go on, have a go.
Well, the twists start with the title. I never knew this definition, but a sharper in the noun sense is one who lives by their wits. Apparently it's an old school term for a con artist, so it's not an adjective in this movie. So yeah. I was completely thrown by the opening caption. I mean, all bets are off. I don't know where I'm going in this. I might as well be in the quantum realm because this is like a total magical mystery journey. But yes, it's essentially about a collection of con artists, some of whom are working together, some of whom are not, some of whom have secret alliances with others. No one is who they appear to be, but the main characters are played by Sebastian Stan, Justice Smith, Julianne Moore, Brianna Middleton, and there's also John Lithgow in the mix as well, as more of a supporting character. But it is more about those other four. The plot kind of revolves around them. It sort of starts off with like a romantic drama, really, with Justice Smith and Brianna Middleton's characters having a meet cute in a bookshop and building a relationship. I was quite enjoying it as a sort of pleasant romantic drama to start with, to be honest. But then it does take this big twist. Sebastian Stan's character comes into it, and he's very devious and unpredictable. And that's where all the sort of conning and cheating starts. But yes, I think to say much more would be spoilers. But essentially, it is all about money. It's about huge lumps of money that everyone is after.
Yeah, I mean, it's divided into five chapters. So you follow each character. And obviously, as you say, it starts with this meet cute. And then as those chapters proceed, they feed into that first story in ways you perhaps hadn't anticipated, or perhaps you have. Depends on how sharp you are. but because it opens with that, what sharper means, you're always watching this story, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, where's the con? So from that point of view, it's kind of, you are already doing the detective work as soon as it starts. And for me, that I found a bit annoying because I did guess who was not telling the truth and who was. And so from that point of view, the delight of the twist, and also to talk about it without spoilers, somebody cons another con artist in a way that I don't believe that person would have been conned, because if they're as good as they are to get where they got, they wouldn't have fallen for that particular thing. So it felt a little not as tight as it could have been and not as smart as it could have been. You know, it didn't give me the thrill of when I watched The Sting for the first time and oh my God, X, Y, and Z are not dead. You know, it didn't have that for me. Did it work for you? Did you feel the con?
No, not entirely. But yeah, I thought it was quite slick. They're all very watchable actors. I especially enjoyed Julianne Moore's performance. I think she has some great reactive moments. But yeah, I found it quite hollow experience, really. I didn't really root for these characters. I mean, after perhaps some initial interest in them, by the end, I didn't really care about them or who was conning who or who was going to walk away the winner or the loser, really. I felt it was lacking some charm. I mean, you mentioned that, like, The Sting. I mean, that has like bundles of charm, and you really do root for these characters. But with this, I didn't find that. It sort of reminded me a bit of Focus, the one with Will Smith and Margot Robbie, where it's just twist upon twist, such that you just don't feel invested in anything because you know the rug's going to be pulled at any second. So you're just kind of lapping up the good-looking actors and the scenery and the lavishness of it all. But yeah, just a little bit of an empty experience really overall for me.
Yeah. I mean, Justice Smith, I think, has a great deal of charm and he is delightful as this sort of central character that everything sort of revolves and centrifugally spins out around him. But yeah, again, I can't say it without spoilers, but essentially you kind of can't feel much for him because you just think, this is going to happen to you and I can see it coming a mile off. So, as you say, very difficult to invest in anyone that you cannot envisage a happy ending for because some bugger's going to come along and rip their heart out or their savings out of their account. So it's tricky to like, more to admire.
Yeah. And some of the big moments I felt were kind of undersold. Some of like the big reveals or some of the more dramatic moments. I mean, probably not a spoiler to say that violence plays a part at one point in the movie, but I felt like those moments didn't really have enough impact for you just believe them in the moment, even if you're thinking, oh, this is going to be reversed in a second. It didn't sort of carry me along moment to moment the longer it went on. And I did find it quite overlong as well, I have to say. Could have been a bit tighter.
Let's talk about Sebastian Stan, though, doing another nice job in absolute awful people. I do enjoy Sebastian Stan playing awful. I loved him in Fresh. Yeah. I love him here. He does a nice little dance in the kitchen. I'm here for Sebastian Stan being a rogue.
He does it so well, doesn't he? Yeah, he's very scuzzy in this. Scuzzy and sleazy.
Very sleazy.
Yeah, he seems to embrace playing that and does it incredibly well. So if you're a Stan, I think you will enjoy this. But otherwise, I'm not sure. I think I would probably rather stick with the Sting or one of the Ocean's movies.
Yeah.
Really, if I'm going to get my con on.
If you're going to get your con on. I mean, the one good thing about Sharper is it is on Apple Plus. So you don't have to invest a great deal to go to the cinema to see it.
No.
It's something that is very good to put on, on a Friday night with a little beverage, a packet of crisps, and just sort of have it play and then think nothing about it ever again after you've watched it.
It kind of, do you remember that film Confidence that came out nearly 20 years ago with Rachel Weisz and Paul Giamatti? It sort of reminded me of that, where it's kind of, it felt like that was a very much a post Ocean's 11 type of movie, but it felt like a kind of a con in itself and it was trying to impersonate the kind of better examples of the genre. And I sort of found that with this one as well, like lots of stars, very polished, but ultimately doesn't really leave you with a great deal.
Yeah, a bit like people whose bank accounts have been emptied. Okay, so if you fancy Sharper, you can see it on your settee. It's on Apple Plus from Friday. Right, film of the week, Matthew. What are you going to choose?
It's a tricky one. I think the best film of the week is The Inspection, but as a Marvel kid, I'm going to go with Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
I'm going to agree. I would not have thought that would have been my choice, but I actually really enjoyed it and was along for the ride and liked all of the jelly items that were flobbering around on screen. I really feel like if you go into that film, you need like some Haribos or some really like gooey, chewy sweets just to enjoy with that. Because there is an ingestion of something that looks very sugary in the film. So I think you want to pop something similar in your mouth. That's my suggestion. Anyway, before we go, we should say that we have a current issue out on sale with John Wick 4 on the cover, but it also has a feature on Sharper and on Ant-Man 3. So if you want more information on those films, it's a great read. Before we go, though, time for a listener's question. Okay. I'm about to start a new job. What film should I watch for inspiration?
Oof. Well, I'm going to go with one of my teenage favourites and say The Secret of My Success. Because that paints just this glorious picture that work is all play and no work, really. It's just kind of running around, being chased, doing all kinds of weird, fun things, kind of working your way up quite easily without doing too much work, exploiting loopholes, charming everybody in sight, maybe taking your trousers off, although I would not recommend that, especially not on your first day. Anyway.
And don't do that in the Total Film Office, please. Thank you.
No, we don't have that anymore. No. Yeah, I think that'd be quite a fun one. It's quite sort of buoyant and optimistic. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a yuppie nightmare, I suppose, if you look back on it now. It's such an archetypal 80s movie, but just loads of fun, really.
Well, yes, let's hope that whoever is going on this new job gets that version. Mine would be Office Space. It's an absolute classic. And if you want, it doesn't matter what job you do, you know, you're always going to have to do those top sheet reports and fill in those sodding forms, and the photocopier is never going to work and it's always going to need loading with A4. The commute's always going to be terrible wherever you're going to, and there's going to be people in the office that you just can't stand. But it's a universal thing. Everybody has that. So I feel like that film really should make you feel that you're not alone in the world. Everybody is having quite a crap day in their office, no matter how glamorous. We have very crap days in our office, don't we? And our printer is not the best. We don't. I'd like to take our printer out into the car park and beat it to death with baseball bats whilst a rap track plays. I absolutely feel that.
I avoid it at all costs unless I absolutely have to use it. But yes, it's the bane of our existence.
It is indeed. Okay. Over
many years.
So on that note, I'll see you in the office after this.
Indeed.
we can go and queue for the microwave. It's almost lunchtime. Shall we have the microwave queue? Why is somebody always doing a baked potato when you want to just zap your soup? Yeah, I had to have a cold soup the other day because, frankly, I couldn't get near the microwave. So it was not a soup. It wasn't a soup that was intended to be chilled. And it wasn't a pleasant experience. So, yeah, that's another thing. Anyway, on that note, we'll go and queue up for the microwave now. Say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.